From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This weekend, nearly 12 million Americans will get a bump to their credit scores. That's because reporting agencies are scrubbing off tax lien and civil judgment black marks, leaving millions with shinier financial records. At the same time, U.S. household debt now exceeds pre-crash 2008 levels, highest ever. This hour on Point, American consumer debt and the way of our credit scores. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is your credit score an albatross, a mystery? Is it holding you back from renting an apartment, getting a job, leasing a car, buying a house? And how are we doing on debt? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we'll look at the European Union levying a $2.7 billion antitrust fine against Google and what that means. But first, joining me from Los Angeles to talk credit scores is Liz Weston, a columnist at NerdWallet. Love that name. A website offering personal finance tools and advice. She's also a certified financial planner and the author of 5 books, including the best-selling Your Credit Score. Liz Weston, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
What are they doing with credit scores? Why are they messing with them?
Well, what they're doing is basically taking virtually all civil judgments off credit reports and most tax liens, or maybe half of tax liens, is still to be determined. And the reason they're doing this is not because the regulators came down on them or out of the goodness of their hearts. This data is problematic. It's really not reported well. Sometimes it winds up on the wrong person's credit report. And most importantly for the credit bureaus, it causes a lot of complaints. They get sued over it all the time, and they can't properly prove that they've got the right information in the right file. So the three credit bureaus got together after a massive settlement 2 years ago, trying to decide what to do and how to make things more transparent and basically get this off their plate so they don't have to worry about it.
I want to come back to why they don't have the right records, but civil judgment, I never had one. What is that?
Well, this is when you get sued, and it can be, you know, back child support, or it could be a debt that you let go, and you get sued in court, and they get a judgment.
So, and you owe money.
Yes, you owe money, supposedly, and they can use that judgment to get a wage garnishment or something else. Mm-hmm. The issue is there's a lot of debt buying companies out there that are buying debts for pennies on the dollar, slapping lawsuits on people, not notifying them. And even if the people are notified, they tend not to show up in court, so the companies get default judgments. And this has been – there's a huge uptick in this kind of activity, which has made these, you know, civil judgments a lot more problematic in terms of whether the right people are being sued.
And lots of them out there are people making big business out of this tax liens. I mean, you haven't paid your taxes. You owe taxes. That would seem relevant to your credit worthiness, wouldn't it?
Well, it typically does. Actually, both things do. But the thing is, when you take this information off the credit reports, what the credit scoring companies found was most people still have other black marks. So if you have these judgments or tax liens, you probably have other credit problems. So they realized that it wasn't necessarily that predictive. In other words, it wasn't – you know, they weren't going to take this information off and then all of a sudden a bunch of deadbeats will look creditworthy. They found it wasn't that helpful.
So they've got kind of other means of figuring out what's going on with all that. I mean, they've been talking about this for a long time. These were right at the heart of here's a FICO ad. This is from 2015, detailing the criteria that could hurt a consumer's credit score. Of course, that included, you'll hear, tax liens, judgments, civil judgments. Here they were.
Have you had debts turned over to a collection agency? Do you have tax liens, judgments, foreclosures, or have you filed for bankruptcy? The more recent, frequent, and severe the reported negative items are, the bigger the impact on your scores.
I always love the jaunty music they put behind that list. Of course, it could be a real bummer. And the problem is that a lot of people got, tagged with having these problems when they were incorrectly identified. You know, you may be John Doe. Some other John Doe had the civil judgment. Here was... this was comedian John Oliver talking about this on HBO's Last Week Tonight back in 2016.
It would be bad enough if this just involved the three big credit bureaus. But on top of that, there are now hundreds of different companies providing even broader background checks. Take Samuel Jackson from Chicago. No relation to the actor, obviously, or to the three different sex offenders one company confused him with, even though one of those convictions happened when Jackson was just 3 years old.
Okay. If your name is Samuel Jackson, all that could come down on you. How does it happen? Are they just that sloppy with the records, Liz, that, you know, somebody else's civil judgment could end up on my record just because we share a name?
Well, the problem is that they weren't using proper identifying information. And all the credit bureaus wanted or asked as a bar is that they have the name, the address, a date of birth, or a social security number. So name and address, and then either date of birth or social security number. And you know, most of the records did not have that, or they weren't being updated frequently enough. They're supposed to be updated like every 90 days, I think, is the new standard. And when the credit bureaus applied that standard, most of the civil judgments in the country just couldn't stand up to that. They're just not being reported frequently enough, or they don't have the proper identifying information on that. So yeah, a lot of people were getting tagged with debts that weren't theirs. You know, files were getting mixed up. You got to imagine that the credit bureaus are dealing with billions of bits of data every day.
Yeah.
So there are going to be some mistakes, but this was kind of egregious.
So 12 million people affected by this, they'll get a bump. How much of a bump? Is it like, woohoo, I'm getting a new car?
No, as I said, most of these people have other problems on their credit reports. They have other debts they didn't pay. So they think the average is going to be about a 10-point bump. The people who are going to see their scores really shoot up are the ones that were unfairly tagged, the ones that the only bad thing on their credit report was a tax lien or a civil judgment. So they might see a bigger jump. Now, I should add that this information is still out there, and there's a company called LexisNexis that's trying to link these reports, the civil judgments and the tax liens, to the proper people. And then market that information to like mortgage lenders. So it still might be a part of the decision-making process, but it won't be part of your credit reports.
Take us into American credit scores these days. I mean, the numbers have caught everybody's eye that we now have more consumer debt in this country, household debt, than ever, more than before the crash of 708, at $12.7 billion headed toward $13 trillion. Are credit scores holding up, or are we stumbling under this debt? How's it look?
Well, actually, it looks okay.
Good.
If you look at the debt burden, what households are paying, it's still all right. The huge red flags haven't gone off. The other thing is the composition of this debt is changing. There's a little bit less mortgage debt, a lot more student loan debt, and more mortgage debt. So it's changing a little bit. But there aren't the signs that are showing us that, a bunch of people are going to flake on this debt.
Take us into credit scores. I mean, you can have a score anywhere from 300 to 850. What's the typical range for most people? How high do you have to be okay, and how low do you have to go to be in real trouble? What does it matter if you got a score of, 500 or 600 or 700 or 800 or 350?
Well, Tom, I hate to make it even more complicated, but there are hundreds of different scoring formulas, and some of them go from like 250 to 900. I mean, people talk about their credit score or the credit score. There's not just one. Even FICO has FICO scores tweaked to auto lending, to bank cards. There's a old FICO score that's being used for mortgages. And then we have VantageScore, which is the rival to FICO. VantageScore is the one you typically get for free online. NerdWallet has a free score. A lot of other places have a free score. So you're talking about a whole bunch of different formulas out there. If you're talking about the classic FICO score, the most commonly used score now is the FICO 8. That's the one from 300 to 850. And, you want to get definitely over 7720. Once you're over about 760, you're golden. You don't need to worry about it. But interestingly enough, there are people obsessed with getting an 850 score. That's like their life goal is to get up there. It makes no difference whatsoever, but that's what they want to do.
This is like one of those numbers that walks around with us whether we know it's there or not, like in a TV ad. So if I'm walking through the world with an 850 or 900, what's my experience of the world? And if I'm walking through the world with a 450 or 400 or 350 or 250, what does that do to me? Start at the top. How's that look?
Oh, boy. There's so many different things your credit score affects. So just starting with lending, if you have a high credit score, let's say that 760 score, you're getting the best rates and terms. Lenders are fighting to get your business. You are seen as a very, very good risk. So you're going to get good deals. And it's exactly the opposite on the bottom of the scale. Once you get below about 620 on the classic FICO or the FICO 8 scale, it's going to be really hard to get credit. If you get it, it's going to be super expensive. So that's
what's the margin between, a high rate if I've got a 600 score and a great rate if I've got an 850?
It really moves around. There's if you go to myfico.com, which sells FICO scores to people, they actually have they keep up with the difference in terms of interest rates and payments, and it can be fairly broad. I mean, it can be the difference of, you know, hundreds of dollars on a mortgage or a car loan, especially if you look at car loans, they're very sensitive to credit scores. So that's it's something that's going to cost you. I once figured the difference between a 650 score and a 750 score was something like $250,000 over a lifetime.
Wow.
You know, with average debt levels. So it's no small thing.
And that's just between 650 and 750, never mind 550 and 450.
Well, and here's where it gets even scarier. Consumer Reports went out and did a huge survey of auto insurance rates and found the difference between a good score and an excellent score can be hundreds of dollars a year in terms of your auto insurance. And, you know, it's sometimes your credit score can make more difference than your driving history. In other words, whether or not you caused an accident. So that's how powerful credit scores have gotten. And that's just one area of our financial lives is auto insurance.
We've been hearing a lot about subprime auto loans. Presumably those are auto loans to people with low credit scores these days. There's a kind of a – I mean, some people have even said that's a risk like the housing risk was back in 07, 08.
Well, people are talking about a bubble, but you have to understand the average auto loan, it's big, but it's still – $30,000 compared to the typical mortgage, which was $200,000, $250,000, $300,000.
But isn't it about packaging them all together? I mean, that's what that business is all about, isn't it? The big banks who package them, sell them, and then you get in, you get these sort of crummy pools of debt.
Oh, yeah. That definitely can cause some damage. Whether it can cause the kind of damage that could bring down an economy like happened last time, that's more debatable. But yeah, the subprime auto loan market is going nuts. And it's – if you look at $30,000 as an average loan, most people cannot handle that. I mean, even if they've got good credit scores.
What percent of Americans are burdened by a bad credit score, would you say offhand?
Oh, I wish I knew, but it's a chunk of people, definitely.
We're looking at credit scores and American consumer debt. It is at an all-time high. Janet Yellen saying yesterday she's not worried about a new financial crash in our lifetimes, but that's a lot of debt out there. You may be carrying some of it yourself. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what's in your credit score and American consumer debt and borrowing a decade nearly after the Great Crash, the start of the Great Recession. Liz Weston is with us from NerdWallet, the website that often gives personal finance tools and advice for consumers, author of Your Credit Score. And you can join us this hour. Do you know your credit score? Do you care about it? Do you keep track of it? What about overall American consumer borrowing? Do you worry about it? Has your credit score helped you or hurt you when you've gone for a mortgage, a car loan, even a job? What's your question on how it rises and falls? Starting July 1st, three major credit evaluation companies will stop considering tax liens and civil judgments because they just couldn't sort out which of those problems belong to whom exactly. All the wrong people were getting named too often. Here's credit specialist John Ulzheimer talking with NBC's reporter Jolene Kent about what the change will mean for consumers.
It's good news for the consumer, clearly, because the credit score is used almost ubiquitously across the world of consumer finance.
Are we going to see more people buying houses and buying cars?
Well, what I'm seeing is humongous excitement, primarily from people who have liens and judgments, because now they realize that they don't have to sit there and wait 7+ years for these things to age off of a credit report organically.
Ooh, the 7-year wait for that organic aging off. It sounds like ripening cheese. Here's Anne-Marie Andreides, talks about consumer lending and credit cards in the Wall Street Journal video, describing the average amount that people's credit scores might rise.
So for about just under 11 million people, we're talking about an increase of less than 20 points. For about 700,000 people, we're talking about an increase that's beyond about 40 points.
So that's significant.
That's significant because that means that could be the difference between getting approved or denied for credit.
And overall American debt, it's at an all-time high. This is Andy Howitt, research economist at the New York Fed. Liz, he says increasing debt is a sign of optimism for the future because people believe that to make these debts, they must be able to pay them off in the future. So that's good. So there's optimism in the debt, Liz.
Yeah, debt is not necessarily a four-letter word. It allows you to get education. It allows you to get a car to go to work. It allows you to buy a house. So you remember after the crisis, we had like a five-year period where people were not that happy about taking on debt. They were deleveraging, which means they either stopped paying their debts, they were in foreclosure, they were paying down their debt. Everybody was a little nervous. So the idea that you would sign up for an auto loan or a mortgage shows that you've got a little bit of optimism about the future. So yeah, it's not necessarily a bad thing.
We're going to go to Michelle Dickerson in just a moment in Austin, Texas, to talk about the big American consumer debt picture. But I want to get some of the credit score questions in here, if I may, Liz. John is calling from Charleston, South Carolina. John, you're on the air with Liz Weston in L.A.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Just a comment here. You know, I went from an 803 credit score, and I was building it up as a business partnership. And I was paying two of the major credit bureaus. Yep. And a monthly fee it was funny how it increased. Well, I ended up on the wrong end of a business partnership breakup, saddled with $200,000 in personal guaranteed loans with no way to pay it back.
Yeah.
And within 2 months, so I had to pull that trigger for bankruptcy. Within 2 months, I watched my credit score go from an 803 down to somebody who hasn't paid a bill in 15 years. Mm. Now, all of a sudden, I found out that what a credit score truly means.
What was the impact on your life, John?
Well, you found out that you can't get apartments. Like your guest said, your car insurance goes up. But at the end of the day, it's almost a fallacy that the banks have you saddled with, that you have to constantly monitor your credit to keep it up. And I've just learned to live without credit. You know, I mean, at the bottom line, if I can't afford it, I'm not going to buy it. And I'm a lot happier that way. Stress with unsecured creditors and any of that.
Yeah, I mean, look, the stress of not having credit is fantastic, but and good for you. At some point, you may want the latitude that comes with being able to borrow, you know, when you want that car or certainly to get that apartment. But Liz, how many people in America are in John's position where, I mean, first of all, they get whacked and their life changes because they can't get credit. But then how many people are in the situation of not using credit, just saying, no, I'm not in that game?
Yeah, there's tens of millions, and this is why there's all these alternative scores out there trying to find these people and score them so that they can find the creditworthy ones. And John, I just want to say that I understand how you feel, and it's you know, really disappointing to see that kind of drop. Once you file bankruptcy, though, your scores have a chance to start increasing. That's something people don't understand. It's once they actually deal with the debt, file bankruptcy, then they've got a chance to move forward. You don't need to take on debt to improve your credit scores. You need to get a secured credit card and use it, or you get a credit builder loan for a year, build up your score, and then going forward, you never have to, you know, be in debt to someone to have great scores. You can just use a credit card and get decent scores, pay it off in full every month. That's how we want people to use credit cards. The issue is if you don't use credit, your scores can't improve. This is something that people don't understand, that, you know, using a debit card, just using a bank account, yep, that doesn't build your score. You really have to have and use credit to have good scores. You don't need debt, however.
It sounds like you're forced to be in the game. It's kind of a racket in a way. But on the other hand, no debt, no credit, and John's on his way. John, I hope that works out. One more right here. Kannapolis, North Carolina. Rachel, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Liz.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Liz.
Hi.
Hi. I had a question, actually. If they are looking at things like tax liens, like civil judgments, because of the fact that they're so problematic in reporting, why are they also not looking at medical debts, which are equally, if not more so, problematic in the way that they're reported?
You mean some other Rachel's medical debt got laid on your credit score, Rachel?
Yes. Medical debts are... any negative that exists on my credit score is a medical debt that I've been trying to find where it comes from.
Ooh, that sounds like a thicket. What do you say, Liz?
Well, there's a couple things going on here. One is medical debt is problematic. The credit scoring companies have realized it's not as predictive as other kinds of debt. One thing the credit bureaus were forced to do in that settlement 2 years ago was to put a waiting period on medical debt so that there's like 180 days to give insurance time to pay bills and people to get caught up before it's even reported. So that's going to help folks. With the situation of medical debt that doesn't even belong to you, a lot of times, unfortunately, that's identity theft. Somebody has stolen your Social Security number. Somebody has stolen your health insurance information. Somehow they are probably masquerading as you. So that may not be an issue of you know, the files being mixed up accidentally, that could be somebody deliberately using your information. And that's really scary because now their medical information could be mixed up with yours. And, you know, you could be showing as having diabetes when you don't. You could be having all kinds of heart problems or stuff that's really important that actually is happening to you, you know, is getting lost in this data with this other person. So there's an outfit out there, the Identity Theft Clearinghouse or the Identity Theft I'm forgetting the name of it. But there's a lot of information for victims of medical identity theft. And I would urge you to go check that out. Keep protesting this information with the credit bureaus because, you know, if they don't know it's a problem, they're just going to keep reporting it.
It sounds like the ultimate nightmare scenario when your credit, your medical information goes wrong and starts to bleed out into the whole giant universe of credit. Rachel, thanks for your call and good luck. One more right here, Des Moines, Iowa. Then we'll go to Austin. But Hassan calling from Des Moines. Hassan, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. Hi, Tom. Hi, Liz.
Hi.
I'd like to share my story quickly and then I have a quick question. So I had a civil judgment against me last year. I was renting a house, and then the landlord asked me for $5,000 after I bought a house, a new house. Then I sued the landlord, and I had to pay $800 instead of $5,000 that the landlord asked.
Yeah.
Since I'm the one who paid, it counted against me, and my credit score dropped by 120 points.
120 points just because you had a civil judgment, the record on it.
Yes.
Okay.
That was the only bad thing on my credit. I had an 820, 830 credit when I bought my house.
Fantastic.
And, yeah, after that, I was able to buy a car, actually. And I had no problem with that. But when I went to buy a phone from a phone store, they won't give me the phone because of the civil judgment.
Because it was down around 700. That's wild. Okay.
Yeah, but I was able to buy a car with the 700.
Okay. They needed to move the car, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's the computer system.
Yeah.
They don't look at the.
So what's your question?
And my question is, I'm actually on my way to buy a car today. Should I wait till July 1st?
Ooh.
Oh, that's a great question.
Because the civil judgment will be wiped off Hassan's record like by next week. Should he wait,
Liz? No. That's a misapprehension.
Oh,
it starts July 1st. Yeah, no, it's a lot of us got that wrong. It starts July 1st, and the credit bureaus are going to stop reporting new information that's coming in that doesn't have the identifying tags with it.
Oh,
but
it's not wiped clean.
Well, to strip out the old information is going to take a while. And unfortunately, the credit bureaus aren't talking about how long it will take. So I would say it's going to be weeks, months. You know, it's going to be a while. So don't expect your credit score to pop up on July 1st and, yay, everything's wonderful.
But wait a minute. Won't they eventually take off the liens and civil judgments?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's what everybody's reporting.
But think about how massive these credit bureaus are, and they've got to comb through and find this information to pull it out. So it's going to take a while. But Hassan, the one time I recommend people actually buy credit scores is when they are in the market for a major loan like a mortgage or an auto loan. And you can go to myfico.com. You pay $20 per bureau, so $30 in advance, and you find out what your auto scores are, or at least the most used auto scores. Because again, that's going to differ by bureau. If you know where you're going to go buy the car, you can, you know, ask and find out what credit bureau do you use so you can, you know, just focus in on that one. But that will give you a much better idea than any free score could, or even the FICO 8, because auto scores are tweaked differently.
But it sounds like if you're jonesing for that car, Hassan, you may have to wait quite a while for the credit scoring agencies to take the civil judgment off your record. Liz Weston in L.A. with NerdWallet. Please stand by. Michelle Dickerson joins us right now from Austin, Texas, professor at the University of Texas School of Law, scholar of consumer debt, author of Homeownership in America's Financial Underclass. Michelle Dickerson, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So we see these numbers, $12.73 trillion now in U.S. household debt, consumer debt, biggest number ever, bigger than before the recession crash. Is this a problem? Is this a sign of health and optimism? Or what's going on in your view, Michelle?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. It's a sign of optimism in the sense that if people are borrowing, if they're spending, they're optimistic. They're somewhat confident about their economic bottom line. They're feeling good that they'll be able to actually repay the things that they're buying on credit.
Mm-hmm.
There is room to pause, though. There's reason to pause, though, because anytime we see this much household debt, consumer debt, we have to be worried because many of the people that are borrowing don't necessarily have the wages, the income to be able to repay it.
And
That is something. I mean, there's always people who can't, but you have to look at net. Is it so many people that it creates a risk? I mean, we had Janet Yellen just yesterday in London. Let me play the little tape from her. She was saying that the Federal Reserve chair, of course, saying that reforms to the banking system since the 08 crash had been fairly effective, and that she said, doesn't expect to see another financial crisis in our lifetimes. She was talking at the British Academy President's lecture.
I think the system is much safer and much sounder. And as I mentioned, we're doing a lot more to try to look for financial stability risks that may not be immediately apparent, but to look in corners of the financial system that are not subject to regulation outside the area, those areas, in order to try to detect threats to financial stability that may be emerging.
So, Michelle Dickerson, interpret that for us. She's saying, well, we've got better oversight of the banks, and therefore I'm not worried about it in our lifetimes. That's a pretty big statement. Was it always really about how the banks handled the debt, or was it about the consumer debt itself?
I think it's both. And I totally agree that the financial systems are safer and sounder than they were before the crash. And I'll use one example, just sort of the mortgage market. Lenders are no longer allowed to innovate and create some of the crazy mortgage products that they created that allowed people who never should have been purchasing homes to buy homes with no down and loans that didn't amortize. So I think she's absolutely right that the reforms post-recession have made the banking system safer and sounder. The problem, though, is except for the highest earners in this country, most American workers, their wages and income has largely been stagnant. So many people are actually borrowing and using that as a form of wage replacement. So they're not getting increases on their at work, and so they're using credit to replace income, which
that
of course
sounds
makes
dangerous,
no sense.
Like a one-way street, like down the drain.
Exactly. And so when you see things like the—
And you can't blame them sometimes, but still.
Well, we can't blame them at all because for many people, they don't see a great alternative.
Yeah.
And so they're living paycheck to paycheck. And this is especially true with young workers, with the millennials, paycheck to paycheck. They want to live what we would, you know, view as a sort of a traditional middle class lifestyle. They find that they can't do it, especially if they're young Americans and they have student loans that they have to repay. And so they're resorting to credit to be able to finance their lifestyle.
We hear about the student loan bubble. What is it? I don't know how many trillion dollars now in student loan debt. Do you see a dangerous bubble there? It's a super burden for a whole lot of people. Is it a threat to the economy? And for that matter, what about the subprime auto loans we've heard a lot about lately?
I'll do the student loan. So there's good news. It's hard to imagine if there's ever good news with student loan debt. But there is some good news because a number of the for-profit colleges that were really preying on particularly low-income students, many of the for-profit colleges are now out of business. So one good thing is that although we do have massive student loan debt, it's not soaring in the way that it had been over the last decade. The challenge, of course, is when you're a young person and you have student loans that you have to repay, you're not doing things that, as a society, we may want you to do. You're not forming your own household. Marriage rates for millennials are delayed. The age group that should be buying homes, sort of the 25 to, you know, roughly 44, 45-year-olds, who are typically your first-time home buyers, they're not buying homes. That's not necessarily good for the economy.
Michelle Dickerson, please stand by there in Austin, Texas. It's great to have you here. And Liz Weston with NerdWallet in Los Angeles. We're talking this hour about what's in your credit score and American consumer debt and borrowing a decade after the Great Crash, the start of the Great Recession. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what's in your credit score and America's consumer debt and borrowing a decade after the Great Crash. Michelle Dickerson with us from the University of Texas School of Law, with us from Austin, Texas, author of Home Ownership and America's Financial Underclass. Liz Weston is here from NerdWallet in Los Angeles, the website with personal finance tools and advice for consumers. We're going to talk before this hour is over about the big antitrust fine against Google in Europe, what that means there, what it could mean here. The giants here, trust questions when Amazon buys Whole Foods, a whole lot of could be questions here as well. We'll look at that in a few minutes. When you get in trouble with your credit score, it can be tough to fix it up. Lots of people credentialed and non-credentialed have taken to YouTube with advice on how to do it. Here's a little bit from a credit consultant named Dan Willis.
You're going to have to focus on two areas and do that simultaneously in order to improve your credit score, and that is building credit while at the same time removing those errors, those blemishes, those negative items on your credit reports, because that's what's damaging and dragging your credit score down. And now listen, your credit score is a lot like your grade point average. You can be acing every single class, but if you're failing underwater basket weaving, it's going to screw your GPA all up.
Liz Weston, I don't know what Mr. Willis means by underwater basket weaving there, but are there like subtle pitfalls that could drag your score down that you might not even be aware of? We know if you don't pay your bills, that's not going to look good, but are there other things that can mess it up?
Yeah, people are surprised to learn how much importance is put on credit utilization. And what that just basically means is how much of your available credit you're using. So if you have a rewards card and you are maxing it out every month, it's going to look bad to your credit score, even if you're paying that off in full, mm-hmm. which, again, is what we recommend everybody do. Don't carry mm-hmm. credit card debt.
Yep.
But you need to take a look at what your credit limits are and try to stay under 30% of that limit at any given time during the month. And if you do carry credit card debt, you may need to spread it around to a bunch of different cards to make sure that you're not gobbling up too much of that available credit.
Michelle, what percentage of Americans do carry credit card debt, and what percentage month after month, and what percentage carry significant credit card debt?
Well, there's again, I always try to find the good news when I see high household, you know, yeah. household debt is increasing. One great thing about the level of credit card debt now, in contrast to the levels at the recession, is that it's not as high. It could be because—
The amount per household, you mean, or the amount overall?
Both.
Okay.
And I think it's because the lenders restricted credit quite a bit after the 2007-2009 recession. Mm-hmm. And so people— many people weren't able to get credit cards, and so they weren't able to charge as much. One of the other great things that I think happened when they weren't able to get credit cards and they couldn't borrow and charge as much is they actually, when they were deleveraging, they started saving. So household savings rates also went up when people stopped using their credit cards as much. One problem is now that the credit card debt levels have started to increase, household savings has started to decrease, which obviously isn't good.
No, never good. And yet, again, if you're doing wage replacement, it's hard to save if you're doing that on credit. Mike in New York, Lakewood, New York. Thank you for calling, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Our story is kind of short. We got into a bunch of medical debt. We were doing very well, double income,
yeah.
No kids. And yeah. then... got into catastrophic illness, and we were brought up, both of us, to pay your debts.
Yep.
We didn't go bankrupt, and we could have. We could have gone bankrupt twice, and our credit would have been reestablished rather quickly. It's taken us, with my wife really heading the charge and also working three jobs, it's taken us a long, long time, years and years, almost 15 years, to get our scores up to where they should be. Give you a quick example of why we think it's rigged against the consumer.
Okay.
If you're late with one credit card payment, yep. you get dinged pretty well. We paid off $7,500 in one payment
yep.
on a credit card, and our credit card scores hardly went up a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's all the sort of hidden things, like if you take out a card, your credit card gets dinged. In retrospect, we should have gone bankrupt. It would have been much, much better for us.
Wow, you feel punished for your sort of old-fashioned values there.
Yeah, exactly. We are being taught to chisel. And and also, we're still dealing with some stuff and just heard the advice that we appreciate that we should be spreading our credit around to several different cards instead of having one card that we were trying to put with the best rate and pay off.
Mike, I just have to grab you on the medical debt. It took 15 years to pay off and rebuild the credit score. You must be paying attention to the healthcare debate right now. I mean, we can't get into every detail, but I mean, what are you thinking about the conversation? If you had two good jobs, no kids, you were in good shape, and then that sunk you for 15 years, you must have an opinion.
Yeah, I have an opinion. And the part of it is the fact that people don't understand what goes on with all the ancillary costs that are outside of major medical and things like that, that continue on and continue on. My particular illness meant that I had to do outpatient stuff for years and years and years.
Yeah.
And, you know, every provider, every person who runs an x-ray department or anything like that bills you an individual fee, and it just continues on and on and on. And when I sit in, union meetings, I was a teacher at a community college. I'm retired now. But I sit in union meetings, and they'd say, well, you know, we can have a saved part of our plan can be that you could have money going into a healthcare bank. And I remember when my wife and her father stood up and unrolled the first bill from 3 weeks in the hospital back in 1983.
Yeah.
And it rolled across the floor.
Yeah, like you're going to be able to save for that.
It was six figures.
Yeah.
How the heck are you going to save for that?
Yeah.
So I hear all these jokes, and I listen to what's going on from both the Republicans and Democrats who don't go after the real cost, which is going after the pharmaceutical companies that own those politicians, like not allowing Medicare to negotiate like the Veterans Association can for pharmacists and things like that.
Yeah.
People are totally unaware.
Mike, I guess you're aware and aware by tough experience over many years of what it can take when you're hit with that. And it reminds us, I mean, whether it's wage replacement, Michelle, which is bad enough going to your credit card just to keep life going, or you get whacked in a serious way. But overall, Michelle, you're not worried about the consumer debt level at this point in this country. Do I read you right?
And the reason I'm not worried about it at this point is because mortgages have not returned to the level. The mortgage debt is not what it was in before the crash. So even though, and we didn't talk about, you'd mentioned in the in the earlier segment about the auto loans, and we can talk about that now if you'd like. So the auto debt is a problem. Auto loans, the auto debts, and delinquencies, sort of, you know, people not paying, are at historic highs. But as Liz mentioned earlier, you know, sort of the cost of a Kia is not the same thing as the cost of a house. So although I think we may be in a bubble situation with the amount of auto debt, especially the subprime auto debt, even if we have a crash, it won't be as devastating as the 07-09 crash because just the numbers are smaller. So as of right now, I don't see that we're going to return to the catastrophic effects that we had to the economy in 07-09. But I am concerned. And I'd like to pick up one comment that the caller Mike just made about the medical debt. When we look at the reason that families are struggling, it's because of the big things that they can't pay for: medical care, housing, and college. And until we can fix that, we're going to have a hard time making life feel secure again for a lot of American families.
Boy, those are giant continents of life right there to have insecurity on.
Exactly.
Crazy thing that in our country, all three of those can be so, joyful if it works and really threatening if it doesn't. And for a lot of people, it's not working right now. Michelle Dickerson at the University of Texas School of Law, author of Homeownership and America's Financial Underclass. Wonderful to have you with us from Austin today, Michelle. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Liz Weston at NerdWallet in L.A. You're terrific. Thank you very much for joining us today, Liz. Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure. It's great to be here.
In a moment, we will take a look at the EU's record-breaking $2.7 billion antitrust fine against Google. This is On Point. Yesterday, the European Union slapped Google with a $2.7 billion fine for antitrust violations. It shattered records. The EU claimed the huge American company shut down competition from the little guys. We want to look at how far this could go. And Google at home in the USA, joining me now via Skype from Portland, Oregon, is Clint Finley, a reporter for Wired, who wrote a story yesterday headlined, "Google's Big EU Fine Isn't Just About the Money." Clint Finley, welcome to On Point.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Let's listen for just a second to the sound of Europe speaking here on Google. This was Marguerite Vestager, European Union antitrust chief, on Tuesday condemning the way Google had been doing business. She was talking in Brussels about the consequences, she said, of Google's practices there.
It has denied other companies the chance to compete on the merits and to innovate. And most importantly, it has denied European consumers the benefits of competition genuine choice and innovation.
All right, Clint Finley, I mean, we got the basics of this. In Europe, as here in the States, if you go to Google and you look for some product, they're going to put their own options are going to pop up sooner than maybe others who are offering access to finding out about products. We've come to take that for granted. Europe doesn't. What's the difference in perspective, Clint?
Well, you know, one big difference is that in the United States, we tend to think about antitrust in terms of the impact on consumers, especially the cost of goods. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for something like Google or Facebook, where something is free, you know, there's less of a sense that consumers are being harmed because prices aren't really changing. But it used to be, and it still is in Europe, that antitrust is also about the impact on competitors, so smaller businesses or even other large businesses.
So they've got a sense, I mean, listening to what they're saying, look, it's the principle of the thing. Google is supposed to be a search engine. Instead, it's turning into a kind of a self-promoting store of its own. And they're saying, no, if this is where the economy is working, everybody should have access to the consumer through it. Is that more or less the gist of their complaint?
I think so, yeah. I mean, and there is also the sense that if competitors are harmed, then consumers are going to end up being harmed in the long run, even if you're not seeing, you know, a big difference in prices right away. Though there is also the objection that maybe the EU is cracking down on foreign companies, in this case, U.S. companies, because they don't have their own big tech giants. And that's a complaint that even President Barack Obama made last year.
Protecting their own. Is $2.7 billion a big deal to Google or a chump change? What is it?
It's not insignificant. But at the same time, I believe their revenue in the last fiscal year was around $90 billion. So, it's not... It's less about the fine for them and more about having regulators kind of come in and tell them what they can and can't do with their search results. Google has been trying to be with the search engine more than just a list of links to other people's sites. They want to be the answer machine that gives you restaurant reviews, that gives you movie times, you know, whatever it is that you're looking for. They want to just give it to you on that page without having to click and go to another site. So with this case, you know, they're going to have to change what they do with the shopping results in the EU, and that opens the door for them to start making changes in other areas, like perhaps restaurant reviews.
I mean, this is pretty interesting because they have $90 billion in revenue, and they're. Their net is probably all right. They can handle $2.7 billion, but this is big enough that they can't just blow by it. They couldn't take repeated fines of that size and just ignore them. So they're going to have to change, I guess, the way Google functions in Europe. Is that a big deal for a company the size of Google to have its essential service working in two different ways, one way in Europe and one way in the U.S.?
Well, yes and no. I mean, that is a big deal, but it already works in different ways in different places. They have localized versions for different countries. You know, there's several different languages spoken across Europe, so each different country has its own version of Google already.
Language is one thing. Fundamental function is another.
Right, yeah. And the results are different, you know, from city to city, here, even here in the United States. But you know, over there, they're having to make some pretty big changes. There's already this the right to be forgotten, which requires Google to remove certain search results that are outdated or inaccurate. So it definitely is going to have an effect on how they manage things.
You write for Wired. You're feeling the pulse of this. Does it get American tech giants nervous when the antitrust impulse stirs in Europe? Do they start wondering, will that happen here too? I mean, we've seen an awful lot of consolidation. We just saw Amazon taking over Whole Foods and not much of an antitrust conversation around that I heard anyway. Is there a sleeping giant here of antitrust concern about the tech giants really taking over and owning the platform of so much of our economy?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely become a bigger part of the conversation over the last couple of years. And it's hard to know how much that's going to change, though. know, Donald Trump, President Trump has said that Amazon has huge antitrust issues. He has said that he wants to block the AT&T and Time Warner merger. But on the other hand, he praised the Bayer-Monsanto merger proposal. So it's hard to say, you know, when you've got a situation where Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post, Time Warner owns CNN. So it's hard to say how much of this is just bluster targeted at companies that Donald Trump has a personal beef with versus, you know, a real change of philosophy in how antitrust will be enforced in the United States. It's also a bit harder to bring an antitrust case in the U.S. because it's actually a criminal law as opposed to just leveling a fine. But so the EU actually has an easier time.
Yeah, but in the executive suites at Google this week, do you think they see their trajectory toward global domination dinged by the European fine?
Maybe a little. I think it's a little too early to say, though.
But they are looking at a change in the way they do business, a change in their
Absolutely.
Vision of what they're going to be right there in the EU. Not a small market. I mean, one of the very biggest in the world, even with the UK headed out. Clint Finley, a reporter for Wired, with us via Skype from Portland, Oregon today. Clint, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And off goes Google. On Point is produced by Michael DeSocio, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Imada, Camila Kerwin, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, Allison Poli, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, and Gretchen Voss. With help from Alvin Buzinha and Eve Monti, our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.